Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, the property market mini boom. Is the end of the stamp duty holiday going to land the killer blow, or is nothing going to stop the charge? We may get an extension announced in the budget. We don't know much about what Rishi will do, but we can tell you how to preemptively protect your wealth. Plus, as the prodigal son is set to make a return, angry investors who lost over $1 billion from the collapse of Woodford's equity income fund turn on the city watchdog. We try to settle the old chestnut, how many different shares should you hold? And Lee takes on the ultimate lockdown learning, a sommelier course with Aldi. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, like a cockroach, it seems nothing could stop the property market, not even a global pandemic. As lockdowned city dwellers made a dash for more space in the country, house prices rose by an average of 20 grand last year. It was helped, of course, by the chance of stamp duty holiday on homes up to $500,000. Well, that comes to an end on March the 31st, unless, of course, an extension is announced in the budget, leaving perhaps 100,000 deals hanging by a thread at the moment. Will it be a hurdle too many for the property market to get over? Is it about to run out of puff? And if not now, when? Simon, you asked the question. Is the property market hanging by a thread?
Is it hanging by a thread? I don't think it's hanging by a thread. I do think that it might possibly be on a little bit more of a tipping point than many people think. The property market has definitely defied all expectations after the property market freeze at the start of the lockdown. I mean, bearing in mind the market was shut for 6 weeks, maybe at least six to eight weeks. I can't remember the exact period of time. No viewings, hardly any sales went through. People weren't listing their homes. And we were faced with, to use the word of that time, unprecedented times where we were ordered to stay at home. We had the emergence of furlough. We had people losing their jobs. We had people losing their incomes. And we had the widespread expectation that when the property market reopened, there'd be a bit of a bloodbath. When it did, deals were renegotiated that had been arranged before, often on the basis that both buyers and sellers agreed that, yeah, it was probably highly likely that prices were going to fall. And then after a few weeks, something weird started to happen. People had been putting homes on the market, maybe chancing their arm a little bit in a way that they were planning to at Easter, because Easter is prime property listing time, maybe expecting that they were going to have to chip a bit off. But homes that were in demand areas, and we were now talking places that were further out of town, on the edge of the countryside, maybe not so important to be walking distance to the station anymore. Although I love the fact that within about 10 weeks of being told to work from home in the face of what is hopefully a one-off unprecedented pandemic, Britain decided it no longer needed to be within walking distance of the station. The short-term thinking going on there that may possibly come back to bite some people, I'm not sure if the world does go back to some semblance of normal. But anyway, things started to take off and things were doing much better than people thought. And then this rumour started swirling around about a stamp duty holiday. And then it was the rumour that actually Rishi was going to do the stamp duty holiday in November. But then everybody said, well, hang on, you can't do that now that everybody thinks there's going to be one. Nobody's going to buy a house between now and November. And whether he was always going to do it in July or whether he got bundled into it or who knows what happened. But we ended up with the stamp duty holiday. Added some fuel to the fire and things have just taken off. We have the figures are in from the ONS / Land Registry House Prices Index. This is based on sales prices, so actual sold prices of houses. It's as close as you get to official figures for the housing market. And house prices went up £20,000 on average last year to an average of £252,000. That was an 8.5% rise. That is absolutely not what most people were expecting in April/May last year. So what happens now? As you say, stamp duty holiday due to end at the end of March. People are still rushing to get deals through. There is the expectation that if some of these deals don't go through, they will collapse. there is also the expectation that there's going to be sales pulled forward. This is what normally happens with a temporary stamp duty break, is you get sales pulled forward, or when there's a sudden rise, as there was with the buy-to-let surcharge, and then after it, you get a dearth of sales. Is that going to happen this time? There's some sort of indications that some of the heat has come out of the market. We discussed this, in fact, 6 weeks ago, a month ago, where I said I reckon that we'd seen the end of the kind of mini red hot property boom already. But I must say, like, you know, there's what you see in the statistics, and there's what you observe with your own eyes. And what I'm observing with my own eyes and my own ears from talking to people, estate agents, people trying to sell homes, people listing their homes, what I see on Rightmove, the places that you see coming onto the market at what you think, whoa, that is way too expensive, and then going under offer within a couple of days, good homes in good locations, there's still a lot of demand for them. And I think some of this can be traced back to the lockdown saver phenomenon that we've talked about in the past, and the fact that not everybody, but some people have saved quite a lot of money, are salting away money every month, and that is making them feel richer and wealthier. They're feeling less spending and more saving. They feel like they've got a bit more money in their pocket, and maybe that does give them the confidence boost to go, you know what, I reckon that we could afford to move, and also I want to move. And let's face it, life is too short not to do what you want to do. We've all had that over the past year, those moments of sort of seize the day. So let's move home. I genuinely don't know how long this can continue for, though, because, you know, price is going up by 8.5% a year in a country where houses are already way too expensive. It's not a sustainable scenario.
Lee, what's your view of the stamp duty holiday? I mean, isn't it a bit of a false economy to a degree, that the most you can save is 15,000? Average house prices, as Simon just said, gone up 20,000. When we look back on the pandemic year, I don't think stamp duty holiday is going to be one of the things that we're really focusing on. But if we do, how do you feel about it?
Well, you hit the nail on the head there, Georgie, saying, you know, linking that £20,000 increase in house prices, property prices, to you know, the maximum saving on stamp duty. So there has been that kind of effect in there, as in, you know, more people have been looking for houses, more houses come for sale. It's just been a really hot market, and that has driven up prices. But some people that might have been reluctant to list homes have gone, do you know what, maybe now is the time to do it. Maybe this is the time to move. And it's kind of unlocked a vast amount of the property market, I would argue. But in the same breath, I don't think it's just been the stamp duty cut. It's also been people looking for bigger homes, so more expensive homes. So we've seen a real drive towards people looking for detached homes, for example. We had a Halifax report out earlier in the week suggesting that detached house prices were up 10% last year, and that compares to 6.3% semi-detached, 5.8% terraced, and just 3.2% flats. So it shows you that detached homes are going up more than three times in price last year compared to flats. And actually, the leap from a semi-detached to a detached home is now around about £200,000, which is, we live in a semi-detached. We were just having a tentative look around for a detached home. There's no chance. The price difference is absolutely astronomical, and it's been driven up by people looking for more space, looking to be kind of away from people, bigger gardens, all that sort of thing. And as Simon mentioned there, people going, don't need to be near a train station anymore, which I think is a little bit short-sighted. Yes, there's been this whole movement, of course, from working from home, but it does limit your opportunities potentially in the future, depending on what part of the country you are in. But I'm sure lots of people have factored that in their decision process. Now, in terms of stamp duty extension, it's kind of difficult because, again, I know a friend who's looking to buy a property at the moment, and he's saying to me, you know, if I buy a property now, I'll be able to beat the stamp duty. I'll be able to, like, save stamp duty. I'm like, nah, not now. Like, it's too late. And I think actually sometimes people kind of, who are not in the industry or kind of know it inside out, don't realise just how much paperwork, or have forgotten how much paperwork and how much time it takes to get a property sale over the line. And lockdown as well. And then the next question, of course, is, well, okay, then, so maybe from April, I just offer £15,000 less for anything that's up for sale. And I'm like, again, I'm not too sure it works like that, mate. But, you know, sure, go for it. I mean, maybe, depending on the property, depending on how long it's been listed and all of those kind of factors. But I can only guess what's going to happen. But I would be surprised if there's not a slight tapering off of people that have potentially agreed sales and, you know, can prove that they made an offer ahead of time and for whatever reason, paperwork got delayed, all that kind of thing. I don't think that just a massive cut off on the 31st of March for people actually genuinely might have tried to get a property sale through at the end of last year, because let's face it, it can take months and months and months and months. And if you factored in a potential £15,000 and then all of a sudden that all blows up, it's kind of tricky to do that, I would suggest. Now, again, talking about the heat in the market, we have to remember these ONS figures lag a month behind things like Halifax. So Halifax monthly index was actually down 0.3% in January, which was the first sort of small fall for a little while. And we'll probably get a clearer picture from the ONS figures next month because they lagged that time behind. But that there's £250 billion, Georgie, in accidental savings by June. That's the estimate by the Bank of England. Money that people who are fortunate enough to have kept their jobs, have seen disposable incomes drop, seen commuting costs drop, all those kind of things, have stashed away a predicted £250 billion. And as someone commented in that ONS story, you know, how much of that is really going to be directed to the high street or to travel agents? Probably not an awful lot, if we're being quite frank, the way things are looking at the moment. What's the next thing that people might inevitably start looking or thinking about? Moving home, buying a car, those kind of bigger purchases that perhaps they might not have done before and might be interested in now because they've managed to stack up this extra cash. And then lastly, about are homes overpriced in Britain? Well, you know, the argument is, of course, they are. And I know this is a chart that's a favourite of Simon, so I had a look at it this morning. The nationwide earnings to house price ratio, which measures how much a house price costs in relation to average earnings, is currently running at 6 times. And the long run average is 4.5. But it's still below a couple of years ago, but it sort of touched 7. So put all those things into the mix, Georgie. It's an interesting time in property land.
It is indeed, as it always seems to be. But isn't the reality a bit like when you talk about that £250 billion of savings and when you talk about the property market? It's very different in different places for different people. So in that regard, should we just get rid of stamp duty altogether? We've heard proposals of a property levy with the fact that it's so different around the country, so much disparity with house prices. Are we likely to get something like a property levy, Simon?
There's a number of different things tied in here, but I think the common theme that runs through all of them is this theory that if you have an expensive home, that is a good thing. And I think that we need to get away from that theory. I think that goes back decades now. I think stamp duty is partially responsible for this sort of attitude amongst the tax system. Up until Gordon Brown started tinkering with it, stamp duty was a flat 1% on the purchase price above £60,000. Brought in some money to the exchequer, was not considered much of a problem in the market, didn't really distort it. Bear in mind, £60,000 could buy you a nearly pretty much almost an average home back then. If you spent £250,000 on a home in 1997, you were getting a really sizable property, even in London and the southeast. You were probably buying a big detached family house. You'd be lucky if you get a flat with that now in those areas. And stamp duty is graded, so you pay a certain percentage above certain prices. When Gordon Brown started tinkering with it, he started levying those percentages as slab style, it's called. So basically, it went up a notch as you went over a threshold, but you paid that higher amount that you'd gone into the bracket of on the entire price of the property, and created cliff edges all over the place with where the thresholds were. It was generally considered to be a bad tax. George Osborne came, but people didn't really object to it so much in the early 2000s because the property market was going absolutely bananas. Houses were pretty cheap in 1997 in sort of comparison to wages, historic terms. They'd fallen after in the early 1990s recession. They'd never really started to rise again. And, you know, we had cheap credit, mortgage rates were coming down, money was being chucked around, see stuff that led into the financial crisis, etc. And people were thinking that they were making money on properties. I mean, people were remortgaging their homes, taking the money out and then spending it, and being widely encouraged to do it. The rise of the interest-only mortgage was in play without people actually putting in place any form of plan to pay it back. Banks were saying to people, well, you sure you don't want to take an interest-only mortgage? You could buy a bigger home. And it was highly inflationary for house prices. The people weren't so concerned about the tax because, hey, you were going to make that stamp duty back within months in the rising value of your property. Once that stopped, people sort of, suddenly the lights came on. Everyone went, whoa, hang on a minute. This is a bit of an issue. And people were talking about it as being an issue before then. George Osborne changed it around, made it so it wasn't slab style anymore. But because he was so worried about being seen to favour the rich as he was putting forward his austerity measure, he made it that you paid slightly less on any property below a very high level. But above that, you started paying more. But even then, he didn't really reduce the bill that much for the people in the middle. And there are is a big chunk of people who live in parts of the country, London, the southeast, popular areas around the country, who if they want to move to a family home, they're looking, staring down the barrel of £500,000 or more. And the tax bill on that puts people off. You only have to look at how removing the tax bill on that, some of the tax bill, £15,000 of it, a maximum of that, temporarily until the end of March, has incentivized people to move, which says to me that for all the claims that stamp duty isn't a problem, people have a finite amount of money and it all gets worked into it, stamp duty is a problem. And I genuinely would have moved house at least one more time in my life if it wasn't for stamp duty. We would have moved from our flat that we lived in London before we did, probably one more move, maybe to try to buy a house around the corner or something like that. But I was not willing to pay the amount of stamp duty that I was going to have to pay twice in my life. I was just not, you're literally just handing over a huge wadge of your savings to the government. And I was like, not doing that twice. I do it once and then I'm staying in that property for a very, very long time. And I think it's a bad tax. And I think the best thing we could possibly do is can this idea of a stamp duty holiday, which I think is just economically daft because it distorts the market by being time limited. And I think we should just permanently cut stamp duty. Just permanently cut stamp duty by the amount that Rishi has cut stamp duty by for the holiday and just leave it at that. It brings the bills down. You're still taking in quite a lot of money for the Exchequer, you know, a multiple in terms of the amount to what used to be taken in. And I think it kind of starts to shift us away from this idea that expensive properties are a good thing, because realistically, they're only expensive on paper. They just cost you more money. You've got to put down a bigger deposit. You've got to borrow more money on the mortgage. You can only cash it in if you literally cash it in and then go live somewhere else. It's not really a great asset. I mean, it has an investment as a buy-to-let landlord. That's a totally different scenario. But for the vast majority of people, their homes aren't an investment. They're a place to live. And it's too difficult to buy them and they're too expensive in this country. And the economic benefit you get from people moving is quite substantial and one of the reasons for having the stamp duty holiday. So then you go into this idea of a property tax. Should we have some kind of super council tax levy where we pull in some money by targeting people in expensive homes? Again, I you know, unless you're going to go after the really, really rich, the people living in the £10 million plus mansions and things like that, and actually make them pay up, then no, I don't think it is a good idea, because the people who are going to end up paying up are the wealthy middle, not the squeezed middle. That's a terrible term, but it's going to be the people who aren't rich enough to dodge the tax. The really, really rich people will dodge the tax. Mm. So it just becomes another thing that hits that kind of, you know, judged to be wealthy, high earning bracket, things like that. And people get really angry about this kind of stuff. They're like, I paid my mortgage all these years and I paid tax on that money. And, you know, it's my home. And how dare the government come and try to take a chunk of it. Da, 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 da. Look how angry people get about inheritance tax and stuff like that. I'd just leave it well enough alone if I was the Chancellor.
Either way, as to whether we get an extension or not, or get rid of it, or a property tax, or whatever, we shall find out on March 3rd when we have a budget. Rishi Sunak, as we said, has some tough choices. Balance the books, but too much, and you risk choking recovery. You hit people hard when we're not even out of this remotely yet. We've heard proposals to change CGT, the self-employed to pay more, national insurance fuel duty could see rates rise, pension tax relief could be cut. While we don't know what's ahead, there are things you can do to preemptively protect your wealth. So Lee, some of the things we're expecting, and what can we do to protect our wealth when we don't know what's ahead?
We have spoken about this in the podcast, it feels like, for quite a long time now, this kind of what's going to happen in terms of tax rises, how we're going to pay the bill. And I feel like slowly we're going to find out the bad news on the 3rd of March, which is coming along quite quickly. And I think it's going to be quite an interesting one.
Do you think, though, Lee, that's a question. Do you think that we're going to get a lot of sort of tax rises and bad news? Or is he going to kick the can a little bit down the road? Because, well, until we get some roadmap from Boris Johnson, we're still well in this.
I think half and half, Georgie. I think there's a roadmap that's been slowly developed behind the scenes, and we're seeing infection rates go down, and the R rate come down, and all those kind of things are going to put mounting pressure to stop this, you know, this lockdown, and to get people back out spending their money and getting the economy moving again. And it's obviously going to be a fine balance to this, but I would have thought that it's going to be a bit of kicking the can down the road, but there's going to be a couple of little stings in the towel here, because how long can you keep kicking a can down the road before that can gets too smashed up and you can't kick it anymore? It gets too flat. You know, it needs, you know, there's going to have to be some sort of bad news. I would imagine, Georgie, there's going to be something here. And the Prime Minister is not keen, I don't think, on a second, you know, austerity part two, because that's not how he's really aligned himself, and that's not really how he got himself elected as Prime Minister. But of course, a lot has changed since he was elected as Prime Minister. And the other thing that they kind of vowed never to tinker with was income tax, VAT and national insurance. I find it difficult to believe that any of those things would get tinkered with, but who knows? It could. I think a couple of that we've spoke about this before. We spoke about this one-off wealth tax. We spoke about this on the podcast before. Potential option, would that happen? Not sure how popular that would be. CGT is one that the article that went up on our website this week, looking into potential tax rises, in the comments section there was a lot of cross people about CGT, and if there were further sort of a hike in that, people were getting quite cross. Now the temptation with that is that CGT is something that tends to hit wealthier people more than other aspects of society. So for example, if you're offloading shares and you've made money on those shares, or if you own a second property, that kind of thing, it could be an easier one. But of course, it kind of attacks the Tory ethos.
Does it also, though, Lee, affect entrepreneurs who use that as a way to kind of grow their business?
Exactly, Georgie. This is, and the thing is, like, we're swirling all these ideas around, and we've got no idea what might happen. And actually, it's such a fine balancing act. I really, really wouldn't want to be behind the scenes thinking over what is getting, what's going to happen. I think it's going to be quite tough. I think fuel duty, I'll be very surprised if there's not a hike in fuel duty in this budget. It's been something that's been frozen for quite a long time. There's this whole push towards going green, especially when it comes to motoring. It feels like it could be a potential easy win. And you think about it, the amount of fuel that's probably been sold in the last year is down massively because people are using their cars less. So that's probably hit the Treasury quite hard, I would imagine. But fuel duty is already very expensive. It's 57.95p per litre of fuel. That is excessively expensive already, one of the most expensive in the world. So how popular is that going to be with not just the common man and woman who drives their car a lot, but also businesses, you don't have to, you know, transport businesses, that kind of thing. And it's not just those motorists as well. There could be even a rise for things like home fuel, people that are off grid and use tanks. I mean, it's a kind of area that you can imagine, again, there could be a hike because of this whole thing about going green, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of things. There's a lot of things going on. There's a lot of temptation. That the pension tax relief is one that I think people are a little bit nervous about as well, because every year there's rumours that something's going to happen to it. And then every year nothing happens. And then this year there hasn't really been any rumours. Now read into that what you will, Georgie, but you know, I'm not trying to put two and two together and get a million, but I'm just spitballing what could potentially be out there. I guess this is all going to be revealed on the 3rd of March. You can't really kind of...
Yeah, we don't have long to wait. It's all right.
Don't make me wheel off any more taxes and make people angry about my vision for a more taxed future when already we're quite heavily taxed on our wages and then taxed on other things like property and fuel and everything else. It's like, how many more tax rises can there be before people go, nah, I'm packing this all off. I'm going to New Zealand. Oh, wait, no, I'm not.
No, exactly. Look, we don't know what's going to happen. If we don't have anything, any information, how on earth can you prepare your finances for the unexpected? Is it just what you would generally advise, or is there something specific we can do ahead of this budget and any announcements?
I think you can just do what you would normally do anyway. And this is just common good financial practice, is that there are ways and means of making your finances as tax efficient as possible. That's not to say that you are evading tax, but that you take advantage of the things that are offered to you. One of which is an ISA. If you are saving or investing, then it always pays to do that into an ISA. ISA rates on savings accounts are not great, but rates on savings accounts aren't great anyway. The advantage is that interest within the savings account can grow tax-free forever. Now, obviously, we have the tax-free interest savings element of £1,000 or £500 for a higher rate taxpayer. That I would consider to be something that it could get taken away, whereas it's highly unlikely that anybody's going to remove the ISA system. And also, you never know, if you keep saving up lots of money and interest rates ever rise, then you might find that you go over that amount. And so get your money into an ISA. If you're investing, definitely invest in an ISA rather than a general account if you've got the option, because ultimately it means no capital gains tax. That's a tax that could go up. No dividend tax. That's another tax that you could end up paying more on. People have been hit harder in recent years. No tax forms to fill in for dividends or capital gains tax. No need to try and work out what on earth you bought those shares or that fund for over the years and how much money you've actually made on them. And hopefully when you've got your nice big investment pot in years to come that you're going to draw on, you can draw on that tax-free because it's in an ISA. So if you sell up a bit or take the dividends, it's all tax-free. Pensions, these are very tax-friendly. The greatest advantage of a pension is you can't get the money out until you're 55, soon to be 57. The greatest disadvantage is you can't get the money out until you're 55, soon to be 57. So you do have to be careful about what you put in there because you can't take it back out. But you get an instant 25% uplift on money that you pay in, thanks to the basic rate tax relief. And you get back more if you're a higher rate taxpayer, because the principle is that you save into it from untaxed income. So essentially, you're getting an instant boost to the money that you put in, which you can then invest into more stuff, which hopefully will give you an even greater boost in years to come. But they're not as flexible as an ISA. Dividend allowance means you can get up to £2,000 tax-free. Couples can share this between them, so that makes it £4,000. After that, you pay 7.5%, 32.5%, 38.1%, respectively, depending on your tax rate, which is higher than it once was, and the dividend allowance is lower than it once was, in order to target people who are deliberately paying themselves through dividends in order to pay less tax on their income, and have then subsequently been caught out somewhat by the help for the self-employed that Rishi has stopped them from taking advantage of. The fact that ordinary investors, some of whom have spent years building up shareholdings that they rely on the income from the dividends for, have been caught out by this is somewhat unfair, I think, in my book. And we've written about this a lot in the past. But you can still take some dividend income tax-free. And then there's the other things, like obviously your own personal allowance. You can pass some of that between married couples. Inheritance, you can pass assets free between married couples, civil partners, etc. It's just things that you could take advantage of. And on the tax rises thing, the one thing I would say is it's always possible to spin a tax rise as only targeting the wealthy in your budget or in things that you put out to the press and stuff like that. It is much harder to actually pull that off in the general population's heads, who do not necessarily, certainly the people who are going to end up paying more tax off the back of it, do not necessarily just fall for that spin that is put out in the budget speech or in the comments in the press or is leaked beforehand or anything like that. And for that reason, I cannot see a scenario where the Chancellor goes absolutely nuts with a load of tax rises to try and start balancing the books, which, let's face it, are so unbalanced that where would you even begin at a point when Britain will still be in lockdown on that date.
Yeah.
People are still furloughed. People are still being told to work from home. Businesses are still shut. It's still illegal to leave your house. And probably at that point, the children aren't even back at school. Mm-hmm. You'd be nuts to go around brandishing tax rises all over the place. And I don't think Rishi Sunak is nuts.
Fair enough. I don't think he is either. Well, we're going to leave this to one side and we're going to talk about, well, something a little bit different. We spoke about it, I think, a couple of weeks ago on the podcast. You mentioned it, Simon, all about, let's talk about shares, the number of shares that you hold. What is the ideal number? So this is when he spoke to three experts and came up with an answer, which was, it depends. Simon, that's not really an answer. Who did you speak to? And what does it depend on?
We spoke to a person who throws darts at a board. And they just came up with it. We came up with the number. No, we spoke to a number 10, of experts. Yeah. Well, it does depend. Not two. You could hold two. I'll explain to you the maths behind why two is more risky as well.
Depends, Simon. It depends.
I mean, if you manage to just hold two that go up in value, ultimately your risk reward ratio is great until they start falling at the same time, and then you're back in trouble.
Exactly.
It's a good question, right? How many shares should you hold? What is a diversified portfolio? And how many can you keep track of? Okay, because there's two things at play there. There is 50 is a very nicely diversified portfolio. Can you, as a non-professional investor who has other stuff that you need to fill your time with, keep track of 50 separate companies in a meaningful way? I would argue no, you can't. Fortunately, by having 50 separate companies, you've managed to diversify yourself enough that you probably need to worry less about the fact that you can't do that, but you can't do it. So Rob Morgan, investment analyst at Charles Stanley Direct, he said at least 20 to 25, but try to avoid dabbling. So he says you should have 20 to 25 as a minimum, although otherwise you could be overly reliant on a small number of holdings. But he also says it depends on the nature of the businesses you select. So if you're buying into robust, reliable blue chip companies that tend to be lower risk than smaller, perhaps, you know, more early stage companies, then a lower number of holdings may be acceptable. But you can still get caught out. I mean, some of the biggest companies on the FTSE got absolutely walloped by the coronavirus crash and have really struggled. I mean, you know, certainly oil firms, which they are considered cyclical because they, you know, or demand for oil goes up and down with how the economy behaves. But in a way, they are sort of defensive because people always need oil, you know, whatever happens. Well, something happened that meant they didn't it? Everybody was told to stay at home. But Rob says, while not putting all your eggs in one basket is important, you shouldn't over diversify and end up spreading yourself too thin, as I said, so you can't keep track of stuff. Susanna Streeter, senior investment and markets analyst at Hargreaves Lansdown, she said there's no hard and fast rule, but a dozen is a good starting point. So that gives you diversification, spreads your risk, but means that you can try to keep track of them. Then we also spoke to Russ Mould. He has said six or maybe eight. And think about what would Warren Buffett do? Russ's argument was that holding one stock, obviously not a wise move. So the question is, how many should you hold? As long as you're comfortable doing your own research, as long as you understand the companies very, very well, as long as they have strong competitive positions, pricing power, good balance sheets, and skilled management, okay, so they fit that Warren Buffett style mold of you could buy this investment, put it away, not look at it for another 10, 20 years, and then take it out of the drawer, and you'd know it'd be absolutely fine, then you could maybe get away with just six. However, not everyone is obviously Warren Buffett. So he then says about a famous American investor, Joel Greenblatt, who suggests 6 to 8, but across different industries. So there've got to be companies that do different things and are not all exposed to the same risk. This is vitally important. And you need to think about, is this industry that this company operates in exposed to the same risk as this other industry that this other company operates in? And now we get on to the academic look at this. Some very influential work on portfolio size and risk that's been done over the years goes back to that by two New York finance professors, Edwin J. Elton and Martin J. Gruber. In 1977, they published an article in the Journal of Business entitled Risk Reduction and Portfolio Size. And they looked at how the number of different shares in a portfolio affected risk. So they took data from all of the shares listed on the New York Stock Exchange, and they looked at portfolio sizes ranging from one share to 200 to up to 1,000, actually. And they compared it to if you had a portfolio equally weighted to all of the stocks in that index, and then judged a level of risk. And you can see on the chart in this article that I put in to Tanya's article here, how the risk declines on that measure as you hold more shares. So go to thisismoney.co.uk/share-investing to find this if you want to see the picture. The risk level, this is not a percentage, it's just the risk level on their sort of readings. With one stock was 46.6%, 46.8%, sorry. And that drops by just holding just two to 26.9%. If you hold four, that goes down to 16.9. If you hold six, it goes down to 13.6. If you hold eight, it goes down to 12. If you hold 10, it goes down to 11. If you hold 20, it goes down to 9. 50, it goes down to 7.8. Then 100, it only goes down to 7.4. 200, 7.2. So if you're listening to me reading out numbers and thinking about visualizing those numbers, what you will find is that you get the biggest drops in risk in the early stages of adding stocks. Once you get to about 10 and start adding more, the risk declines much less slowly. Now, actually, there's still a sizable difference between 7 and 10, even though they are both relatively small numbers compared to 46. But probably once you get to that 10 to 20 level, you've reduced it as much as you can in a comfortable way while still having few enough shares to keep track of it.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll talk about prudent investing. No, we're not going to. Never a boring week, is there, Simon and Lee, in the world of investing? Bitcoin, GameStop? Hello, Neil Woodford is back. As the disgraced fund manager plans to make this audacious comeback, the City Watchdog is coming in for some serious flack over its handling of the savings scandal. Lee, remind us, Neil Woodford, who he, the implosion of an empire?
Happened? Implosion of an empire, I think, just about sums it up. He was the rock star fund manager that managed to hook in quite a lot of cash over a number of years after some successful performance, and it all came to a head a couple of years ago, and his whole empire crumbled as he was struggling to make returns. Lots of people were trying to take the money out all at the same time, and inevitably it got wound down. Lots of people ended up getting a lot less money back from what they put in, and Mr. Woodford, I'm sure, is living a nice lifestyle somewhere. And people aren't happy about it. And those people that aren't happy about it are campaigners, MPs, peers, and they believe that there should be a separate inquiry into the FCA and how this was all managed, because there's been an inquiry into the FCA's handling of London Capital and Finance, which saw a lot of people lose money. People want to see another probe into the FCA's handling of this. And
what is the FCA's handling of this? What have they done? What are they looking at? Have they done anything?
If you want me to quote someone, Cliff Waite, a director at ShareSoc, which represents small investors, he said that the FCA are toothless and are moving at a glacial pace, and they're dragging their feet and not doing enough. So that probably gives you an indication of how some people feel the FCA have looked into this. But bearing in mind, Georgie, it's just 2 years now. If there's something that was going to be looked into and happen, it should have happened by now. And what's happened at this point, and why people are getting upset, is that it looks like Mr. Woodford is going to make a comeback. And people are saying, is this fair? Should this really happen? This comeback's happening in Jersey, so outside of FCA jurisdiction, and it's going to be targeted at professional investors. Should he be able to do that? Well, yeah, that's up for the jury
to discuss. Simon, what do you reckon? Should he make the comeback? Should the FCA be hammered over this one? Is all forgiven and forgotten?
It's a bit too soon, I'd argue, but he's not making a comeback as a fund manager that ordinary people are going to be investing with. That's not the plan. He appears to be making some kind of comeback that's going to involve some of the kind of like dabbling in the biotech kind of stuff that got him into issues in his major fund. In Neil Woodford's defense, he ran an absolutely massive fund that strayed away from what it was meant to be doing and why many people have put their money into it. But he did publish a full list of all the holdings, so people could actually see that that was going on. So in a sense, he wasn't hiding things. But Neil Woodford and his business partner, Mr. Craig Newman, must have known that all of those billions in the Woodford ginormous fund were not there from people who wanted to go chasing risky biotech stocks and unlisted blue sky companies. They were there because people invested with someone they saw as dependable and reliable, and who invested into big name companies. And it started to get caught out when people started to pull their money out, because a fund is not the right place to be investing in the kind of stuff that he was investing in to the extent that he was, because you have to sell. Funds grow and shrink as people put more money in or pull them out. So you can both be a forced buyer, because you have to buy when people put money in, you have to buy more stock, and you can be a forced seller. And he probably at times was both a forced buyer when the fund was going, was growing in size, and was definitely a forced seller. And he got, and some of the big name companies that were meant to be reliable ones turned out to be bad bets as well. Some of the outsourcers and things that he got caught out by, Provident Financial as well, and stuff like that. And it was just a proper car crash. And people are still very angry about this because they lost a lot of money. Now, Neil Woodford did this interview with The Telegraph at the weekend, who we must give credit to, because it was a cracking interview. Okay. I'll just read you a bit here. Okay. So this is from Lucy Burton's interview in The Telegraph with Neil Woodford. After nearly 2 hours turning over the rubble of his collapsed investment empire, Neil Woodford begins crying. He gets up and briefly walks off camera to compose himself, leaving an empty chair at his West Country home as the star of the video call. Britain's most famous fund manager, now its most famous failed fund manager, finally cracks under questioning about the allegedly macho culture at Woodford Investment Management. Could that have contributed to its destruction? He looks hurt and wells up as he remembers the day he told staff the business was being wound down in October 2019. The tears follow. For those of you who can't see Georgie, she's playing a she's playing a tiny violin at the moment, okay? So he alternates, as it says here, Woodford alternates between sadness and anger as he dissects his downfall in public for the first time. He's ready to say sorry to the ordinary investors who lost out on his disastrous bets, up to a point. I'm very sorry for what I did wrong, he says. What I was responsible for was 2 years of underperformance. I was the fund manager. The investment strategy was mine. I owned it, and it delivered a period of underperformance. But he's furious that the company's administrator, Link Fund Solutions, for closing Woodford Investment Management, and insists after everything he would have been vindicated had it stayed open. I can't be sorry for the things I didn't do. I didn't make the decision to suspend the fund. I didn't make the decision to liquidate the fund. As history will now show, those decisions were incredibly damaging to investors, and they were not mine. They were Link's decisions.
Has anybody looked at how they've performed 2 years on to actually prove, because he said this at the time quite a lot, look, if I'd have just spent more time in, I would have been proved right. Has anybody looked at how those holdings would have done?
No, well, not properly, but it's something that we are looking into at the moment.
Of course.
But it's difficult because some of these companies are, you know, were unlisted, and some of these investments were flogged off, you know, very cheap, and people are quite angry about that as well. Now, he had a very good reputation. The problem is I think that they ended up in a position where they felt their hands was forced. Now, if you're going to invest with a fund manager, you have to accept that there will be periods when they do very well, and there will be periods when they don't do so well. And you do have to kind of be willing to stick by them over for the long-term view. But the problem was this kind of drift into some of these companies. Now, some of these companies have done well since. He invested in Oxford Nanopore, which has since developed a rapid COVID test. I mean, is he telling us that he knew they were going to develop a rapid COVID test before COVID was around? Well, of course not. But what he would say is that I knew this company had the potential to do this kind of stuff. I think the important thing here to remember, though, is that whilst he's apologized for some of these things, he's defended some of his investments. He's claimed that the listing of companies onto the Guernsey Stock Exchange in order to lower the number of unlisted companies in the fund was not his decision, and it was the companies deciding to list on the Guernsey Stock Exchange. He's had a pop at the media, obviously. But he's also sort of commented on the fees. Okay, so he's asked about the £60,000 in daily fees that were extracted after the fund was suspended. This is something people are very angry about, is the fees continue to be taken. They were not cut by Woodford Investment Management. Woodford Investment Management didn't say, we're really sorry, okay, because we're not actually kind of managing your money at the moment, other than it being sat there in the investments that it's in. It's locked in. You can't get it out. Whilst that's happening, we will reduce your fees or we'll cut your fees at the time. Now, he says, from the moment of the fund suspension, Craig and I received absolutely no income or dividends or any remuneration from Woodford Investment Management. None. And indeed, I haven't received any for the best part of 2 years. We had a regulatory obligation to continue. We couldn't just turn the lights out and tell everyone to go home. So the fees that came into the business were used to pay the people who were running the organization. What people have done is conflate fees with money going into Neil Woodford and Craig Newman's pocket. The last pay I received was in May 2019. He said, I don't want to go into the details, but retail investors were not the only people who suffered financially as a result of what happened. Okay, just to be clear, in the year before the fund closed, I think between the two of them, Woodford and Newman took out about £13 million. The year before, I think it was maybe north of £30 million, and they're estimated to have taken out, I believe, £112 million in dividends from that company. If they had not taken out so much money from that company when things were booming, then they would have had some more cash in the company to maybe do the right thing and offer to cut the fees or waive the fees for investors. And I'm certainly not going to start feeling sorry for the two people, for two of the people who lost out financially in that endeavor, the two people running the business. When we've had countless emails from people who invested chunks of their pension, of their retirement fund, of their ISA into Woodford and lost large amounts of money. And Tanya said, our investing and pensions editor, when we were talking about Woodford some time ago on this podcast, and maybe he has done this, maybe he's just done it privately, we don't know about it. Maybe a good thing for him to do would be to give a sizable amount of money to charity, some form of charity that promotes financial education or helps out people, who helps people to, you know, improve their finances or something in some way in order to kind of give something back. Maybe behind the scenes he has done, and maybe he's the kind of person who just doesn't like to make someone dance about it. But
he's in a no-win situation. Tell everyone, but, oh, I've just given all this money to charity, there'd still be people who say, well, that's great, but we want our money back. And also they'd say, oh, that doesn't justify what you've done, and you're just arrogantly saying you've given money to charity. No win.
No, but people are angry with the amount of money that they pulled out of that business and how they cashed in on it and then how the business failed. If they hadn't have done that, people would not have been anywhere near as angry. What they saw was the fund manager and his business partner enriching themselves and doing the opposite of enriching savers.
So that's Neil Woodford as well. But Simon, just briefly, the FCA, are they in any way to blame here? Have we learned any lessons? Are we going to learn any lessons unless they get a teeth and do something about this? And they said, what can they do? What are they looking at?
They could pay more attention to stuff, perhaps. Maybe they are paying more attention to stuff now. They always seem to be a little bit behind the curve. We'll flag things and then we'll ask the FCA about them. They won't comment on it or whatever. And maybe secretly, you know, behind the scenes, they're well ahead of the curve, but they always look a bit behind the curve. And Woodford, one of the reasons why Woodford is angry with the press is because the press have been reporting. The press have come in for a lot of criticism for building up Woodford, okay? But the press had also been reporting on Woodford's struggles for quite some time and warning savers about the fact that Woodford was failing and Woodford wasn't really investing where they might have thought he was investing and things like that. And the FCA didn't really seem to be doing anything about it. The FCA only suddenly like staggered into the light when the fund was shuttered. So I think we just need to see stuff being maybe more proactive from the FCA, and the FCA making people aware that they are being more proactive and keeping tabs on things. And I don't know, ultimately you invest your money, you take your chances, but you need to make sure that people are doing what they're meant to be doing. And then, as I said, you know, in his defense, he published a full list of all his holdings.
Well, I imagine this is not the last time we'll talk about this subject. There's plenty to return to. But finally, Lee. While most of us are just drinking the stuff, or ordering it, in my case, and then posting it on Instagram, Lee has taken it a step further, and he's done a sommelier course. Yep, wine tasting-y stuff with Aldi. Lee, what?
I'm not going to say, Georgie, that this is a professional sommelier course, right? I mean, at the end of the day, people spend many years getting to a very high level, and to be able to be blindfolded and smell a glass of wine and know what one of 28 grape varieties or whatever it is a skill that takes a lot of honing. And to do it at home with Aldi probably isn't going to be comparable. But what I'll say is this, you know, there's been a lot of homeschooling of the kids, obviously, in recent months. And I think it's about time that us adults perhaps start thinking about some more homeschooling for us, you know, a bit of fun. There needs to be some more fun in our lives at the moment. And I got told about this. So this weekend, my wife and I had a romantic weekend instead of just watching a box set or, you know, going literally flicking through Netflix, Now TV, Amazon Prime, BBC iPlayer and going, what should we watch for an hour? Instead, we did our wine tasting. So the idea is this, it's in 8 modules. And it takes you from sort of start to finish about white wines, red wines, rosé wines, different styles, about the process of how it's made, how to taste wine properly, all of those kind of things. And it has a part on its website in which you can go and buy the wines that it's talking about in this course. And each module has a 10-page PDF, which is really handy. And it's quite interesting. This, a lot of stuff is quite straightforward and things you might already know, but other parts were quite interesting, and it was just to fill a knowledge gap, I guess, about wine sometimes, because you know, you, the temptation is to go into a supermarket and you just get blindsided by a nice looking label, and you might not necessarily kind of look at other bits and pieces that you should be looking at to choose your wine. And it was really good, it was really interesting. It's open to the public, it's Aldi Wine School. And you just Google it and it will take you through. The videos that just about 7 to 10 minutes long. Mm-hmm. I just hooked it up to the TV through my MacBook. It was pretty easy. It split it over 3 nights. So we did 3 modules one night, 3 modules another night, and 2 the other night. And I'm going to be writing about it for Saturday's Consumer Trends column, if you are interested in it. But we found it interesting. It was good. I'm not going to say I'm a professional sommelier.
So do you feel like you know more? Do you? I read a book, I think it was Claudia Hammond, talking about money, psychology of money. Psychology says the worst thing you can ever do is know something about wine, because then you get picky about it. And actually, by and large, it doesn't really make a difference unless you are super, super expert on wine and all that sort of thing. And you're really into it. Sometimes just getting that pretty little labeled bottle that's a little bit on sale in wherever you happen to buy it, it's not a bad idea. It's just a bottle of wine, isn't it? I can just hear all those listeners not.
I can get the logic of that. I understand the logic of that. And for most people, they're not probably wine connoisseurs. You know, they like what they like, and it's very subjective. You know, there might be a wine, for example, that my wife really likes, which I find, you know, too tanniny, or I find it's just or it's a bit too acidic, or, you know, that kind of thing. And actually, you realize when you take the time to sort of smell and taste the wine through your nose and give it a good wash around your palate, and you can kind of start to feel the flavors, taste the flavors. But look, Georgie, let's face it, I'm a beer man. And, you know, all I really do at the weekend is drink a couple of nice beers. I very rarely drink wine anymore, mainly because I have a young daughter and I get broken sleep. And the thought of polishing off half a bottle of wine fills me with dread. You know, one glass is my limit when I do drink it. Much more of a summer thing for me. So, look, it was good. It was interesting. It was free. And you know, if you're, it's just, it was something to do, Georgie. If I'm being quite frank, it was something to do and something outside of the ordinary. You know, as I say, the temptation, especially in the last couple of months, have been bleak weather. You know, it just, what do we do? And I saw this and I thought, this sounds interesting. And we had a really good time. It was really nice. We set up a little table and chairs in our lounge, TV on, did some wine smelling and tasting, and then played a bit of Scrabble. Lovely. Perfect.
I decided to do an art foundation degree, but a sommelier course in Aldi just sounds way better in terms of far less commitment. And Simon, lockdown learning, sommelier courses through Aldi. You're a wine man, aren't you? I don't mean it as in you have a wine problem. I just meant, you know, you're a man who appreciates a good wine.
I wouldn't deny having a wine problem, in all honesty. I've done nothing as useful as that. I wish I had. I think it sounds really good. I like wine. I'm interested in wine. I'm not a wine connoisseur of any type. I like a nice bottle of wine. I like to spend money on enjoying a nice bottle of wine. And I like to explore different wines and try different things. I'm not someone who's like, I like this kind of wine and I'm only going to drink this kind of wine. But I think learning a little bit about it helps you enjoy it more. I think that this Aldi wine sommelier course that Lee did sounds absolutely great, and I'm going to try it out as well. Lee said it's quite, some of it's, you know, the early stuff is quite basic, as it is if you do the professional qualifications. The main professional qualification people do in this country is the WSET, and the basic level of that anybody could do. It's fairly simple. My wife used to work with a very long-standing wine merchant, still does a little bit of work with them, Berry Brothers. And I've been lucky enough to meet some of the people there and stuff. And also my brother-in-law is a chef, and he's very much into his wine. And he's done some of his WSET qualifications. The thing I would say is that it's worth spending a little bit more sometimes on a bottle of wine to enjoy it, savor it, because then you might drink it slower as well. That's the other advantage. Maybe if you've just got two, if you've got a £6 bottle, you might chuck back two of them in swift succession. If you buy a £12 bottle and not two £12 bottles, you might savour it that little bit more, because the duty and the VAT on a bottle of wine, plus the shipping costs, the bottling and the retailer's margin, means that in a £7.50 bottle, about £1.43 goes on the actual wine itself.
Wow.
So that's, you know, what's going to the vineyard. So that's £6.07 worth of costs in the bottle, £1.43 on the wine. Spend a tenner and you're spending twice as much on the wine. It therefore follows. So you're actually getting, you're not necessarily getting double the quality,
I get your point.
But you're spending twice as much on the wine. And once you get to about a sort of £12 to £15 bottle of wine, once you start going above that, you're starting to pay more for rarity than you are actually in terms of a vast improvement in quality. Certainly once you go above £20 or £30 a bottle, you're paying for name and rarity and vintage and the fact that it might be a Burgundy, so it's going to cost you lots more money. You can explore different wines that will be that might have some of the attributes of some of those more famous wines, but come from a cheaper, you know, a cheaper area, somewhere that's not considered quite as good, and so on. And learning a bit about it gives you something to do, doesn't it? Maybe slows you down on the drinking front, as Lee said. And there's a great book, actually, that I read. It's called Cork Dork. And it was written by an American journalist. And she decided that she wanted to become I can't remember whether it was a master of wine or a master sommelier or what it was. But she gets involved in the whole wine world and what people go through to get to the top level of the wine world, and tells the stories of it and everything. It's really funny. It's really easy to read, and you learn quite a bit as you're going through it. And the other one that's really good is Oz Clark's book, Red and White, which is like half kind of autobiography and half tells you about different wines and stuff. So yeah,
I like your little book advices. I bought English Pastoral. Isn't that what you recommended to me?
English Pastoral.
And also Naked Wines. I haven't done any sommelier course, but I did get involved, Simon, on your recommendation of Naked Wines. And also, after talking about Oxbury Bank, just to say that I do listen to you guys, I decided to move my money from Marcus, which I put money into after listening to this show, or being part of. I don't just sit here and listen, I do talk as well. And I put some money in the Oxbury Bank to support local farmers. So there you go. I do listen to you guys.
Anyway. You're making us feel like influencers, Georgie. We should be in Dubai with Instagramming ourselves.
Well, yeah. I mean, you could do that. You could do that. It's fine. I wouldn't recommend it, though. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. And you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join the debate and read the comments. And if you've got this far, tweet us and tell us about a decent bottle of wine that you've bought recently that you'd recommend.
Yes. Or anything that you've been influenced by from our couple of influencers here. Love to know. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? Helps people find us.